Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Developer Express. Become a UI superhero with DevExpress, controls, and libraries. Deliver elegant .NET solutions that address customer needs today by leveraging your existing knowledge. You can build next-generation touch-enabled solutions for tomorrow. You can download your free 30-day trial at dx.hanselminutes.com. That's dx.hanselminutes.com. Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today I'm talking with Keisha Josephs. She is getting her PhD in linguistics and already has an MA in linguistics and is also a software developer. Thanks for talking with me today.
Hi, thank you.
So you are getting your, you said your ABD, but you're really like, you're doing your dissertation right now as we speak, probably.
Right. Yeah. I'm very close to finishing. I can feel it in my bones. I just have one chapter left and then a whole bunch of editing to do before I finish. So hopefully I finish by this semester, if not by the end of this year.
Excellent. And then will you make everyone call you Dr. Josephs?
You know, I think I will. I've been actually running that through my head. I have another friend who is a woman of color who has a PhD, and she talks a lot about how she gets more respect when people call her doctor. So, as a woman of color. So I think maybe if it's going to feel weird.
You spend decades in school. I think that you can, I'll call you whatever you tell me to call you. I respect that 100%. As a person that went to community college, you can just call me Scott.
Okay.
So I have a lot of respect for people who put that much work into school.
Thank you.
So, additionally, you are Afro-Caribbean. Specifically, is it Kalinago?
Yeah, I'm Afro-Caribbean and Kalinago, which is a Native American tribe that's in the Caribbean.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest community is in Dominica. There's a reservation there. So there is a Native American reservation in the Caribbean. It's on the island of Dominica, about 4,000. I hear the number's about 2,000 to 4,000 individuals. And then there are other smaller communities throughout the Caribbean, like St. Lucia, which is where my mom's from and where my Kalinago community is. Though I work a lot with the community in Dominica.
And there's a lot more going on in the Caribbean culturally and linguistically, and more islands, I think, than most Americans realize, right? They think Puerto Rico, and then as you go to the east, maybe they, once they get to U.S. Virgin Islands, they kind of just forget that there's a dozen other islands with culture beyond there.
Yeah, the Caribbean is incredibly diverse, and what I'm learning through my work is that it has always been, or almost always been, an incredibly diverse and rich place in culture, in language, and traditions. You know, in the modern times, since they were colonized by different countries, I mean, you can go from one island to the next and have, you know, different accent, a different culture. And historically, there's been a lot of Native American tribes that have passed through there, and have put their own touches on each one of those places. So it's really fascinating. And I think that history does not get, talked about a lot, especially the indigenous, side of, the Caribbean history. I mean, we talk a lot mm-hmm. about Caribs and Arawaks, and every time I read something, I'm like, oh, they got it wrong, because it's so much broader and it's so much wider than what you would read about in the books, right? So you'd mm-hmm. hear Columbus came in and he said he found the Tainos, and the Tainos said, hey, these bad people called the Caribs, and that was that, and then they all died out. And it really wasn't there. There was a lot of trade going on between the groups. There's even some connections to North American Native groups. So it's a really fascinating place.
It is. And it does so easily get, you know, people just kind of draw a circle around it in their mind, and they say that's the Caribbean, you know, and that's it. And, you know, flipping it to the exact opposite side of the globe, you can see why people would be frustrated with like Moana, which was just this kind of mm-hmm. generic Polynesian thing. It was a great movie and beautiful mm-hmm, songs, mm-hmm. but from a cultural perspective, it was just a mush.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really interesting that you mentioned that, because I have one of my friends who is Maori, and she lives in New York and has, you know, three kids now. And it was a big thing in her kids' school, and she has managed to turn that movie into so many teaching moments. I just told her that the other day. So now, you know, the kids love the movie, but they're also getting the like real input from Maori individuals of cultural items. So they just had like a Moana party, but they had like real Polynesian dancers that came and shared authentic Polynesian dance. So I'm like, how cool is that? You know, you're like 8 years old and you hit a Moana party with like authentic Polynesian dancers and have access to all these people that you can actually ask about, you know, the culture and tradition. So that was really great.
That's great. And that's great. That's the time to get it. I mean, my kids are 9 and 11, and that movie and reading about things like that will give them a realization that life is a lot more complicated and varied than people realize. Putting people into boxes doesn't do anyone any good.
Yeah. And it was interesting to see how she struggled with it, because she knew all the things that were wrong with the movie, but she knew that the kids were coming from a very innocent place. So she was able to use that to educate them on some of the cultures and history. So, yeah.
So the culture that you're focused on, the Kalinago, that is both a language and the name of a culture. I want to make sure I get that right.
Yep. So the group is Kalinago, and the name is of the language is also Kalinago. And that's what the community uses. But you might also have heard of Caribs. So we have been called Caribs for a very long time, and it's just a very erroneous term, because so what happened in the Caribbean is that there were Arawakan peoples throughout there that came first, and then there was a wave of Carib peoples that came, and there was a lot of intermarriage between the two. And when Columbus came, since the Caribs were the ones that were putting up a lot of the resistance, of course, they heard from the Arawaks that, hey, this guy's coming in and he's doing bad stuff, put up a fight. So he basically said, okay, it's the Caribs that are the problem. We've got to fight them. And all these people that I don't like are now Caribs. And so the name kind of stuck, and it just causes so many problems. It's like, no, well, we have some Caribs, you know, we have some Carib words and we have some Carib heritage, but it's just like saying, you know, English has some French words, but we're, you know, if you're English, you're not French, you know? So it's sort of that sort of deal. So Kalinago is the best term to use.
And the language was spoken by how many people, and is spoken by how many people now?
It was spoken throughout the Caribbean. And, you know, if you want to say a million people, thousands of people, and it is now spoken by no one. So that language loss, our last fluent speaker, it said that she died. Her name was Mal Gustave, and she died in the 1920s. And since then, there are people who remember bits of the language, so they're rememberers of the language. But since then, there have been no fluent speakers of the Kalinago language.
So if this is what we call, and I hope this isn't offensive, a dead language, is it something that is just like many dead things will just be forgotten, or how do you bring it back? And when you do bring it back, how do you make sure that you brought it back authentically and that you haven't evolved it in a direction that doesn't make it the language anymore?
That's a really good question. And in the linguistic or language revitalization community, there's this idea that you don't call a language dead, you call it dormant. I understand when people say that a language is dead or that it's extinct. And so when someone says that, it doesn't really cause me any offense. But the reason why some people prefer the term dormant is that there's an idea that this language could be brought back. So if you think of something like Latin that was considered, a dead language, or even Hebrew. So Hebrew was actually not spoken at one time. It was, you know, completely gone, and people brought it back. So now it's a language of an entire nation. So it's the idea that, well, if the language is dead, then it can't come back. But these languages came back. So You can call that dormant. But in regards to the other part of the question, so how do you make sure that you're getting it right, basically? So what I do is, first of all, we have a lot of documentation on our language. So we have a dictionary from 1665, it was written by a French priest called Father Raymond Breton. And he recorded a lot of the language, not just words, but he recorded a lot of phrases, a lot of cultural information. And there were also other people who went back to the Caribbean and got various language information at different points in time. So we have snapshots of the language at different points in time. And so we have a grammar from 1889. We have a linguist that went back from 1930s on. And we also have languages that are related to ours that are still spoken. So there's Arawak in South America and Garifuna in Central America. Our language is also slightly related to Wayuu, which also has a lot of speakers in Colombia. So I can use those languages and compare them to my language, Kalinago. And through linguistics, historical linguistics, you can see regular sound changes to see what this might be in my language. So, for example, in Garifuna, the word for like the bow of a bow and arrow is Gimara. Mm-hmm. And in Kalinago, it's Shimara. So where Garifuna tends to have Gi, we tend to have She. So if I see a word in Garifuna has that Gi sound, I know where to look for it in the dictionary. If it's not there, then I can safely say, hey, it probably would have been She, because we don't have Gi in our language. So
interesting.
That's a little bit of the way I do it. And in terms of, you know, authenticity, I think that's something that's asked a lot of indigenous people, that we somehow have to be more authentic in order to be accepted. And it's not something that's asked of other people. So, I don't know your heritage, Scott, but are you an authentic person because do you speak the language of your ancestors, or do you dress in that sort of way? Are you getting it right? You know?
Oh, that's a good point. So that's very interesting that you brought that up, because so I said kind of getting it right, and that's, And by that I meant, like, are we sure we're speaking it the way they spoke it 200 mm-hmm. years ago? Mm-hmm. And you then use the word authentic, which is a valid paraphrasing of what I said. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. I didn't realize the implications of asking that.
Yeah, it's something that
it isn't meant to be a threatening or a pressuring thing. It's meant to be if I was going to start speaking Middle English, I don't know if I'd be speaking it the way they actually spoke it, because there's no recordings.
Right, right.
But then let's say that we all started speaking Middle English and it became the new Middle English. Who cares if we pronounced it right or not? It doesn't make us less authentic, is what I'm hearing you say.
Yeah, exactly. And a language that doesn't change is truly dead. So language is constantly changing. So if your language is one that doesn't change, it means you probably don't have any speakers. So what I try to do in my work is definitely, if it's recorded, try and use that, but also mm-hmm. realize that it's not going to be what was spoken in 1665. It's just not. We don't mm-hmm. have all that information, and you have to be comfortable with that. But then again, I don't speak English like we spoke it in 1665. I definitely don't, although I think it's beautiful the way it was spoken then. But I don't, mm-hmm. and we're okay with that. So, I think that and a lot of communities, Native American communities, struggle with that. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one thing that they have to understand, is that it's not about getting it right or wrong. It's mm-hmm. just doing the work and getting it spoken. And that once it's spoken as a natural language, those language changes mm-hmm. will evolve over time.
Interesting. So then the more people who start speaking this, you'll be chatting with someone in Kalinago, you'll hear the way they pronounce something, it'll feel better or feel right in your mouth, and you'll either consciously or subconsciously pick it up, and then more people will start to say that way, and it grows over years, presumably.
Yeah, and that's a pretty good description about language change in general. So an interesting language change. For example, I remember when I was younger, a lot of when Valley speak started to get popular, especially up talking, like when you ask a question or you ask, say something and it sounds like a question, you sort of do this thing. Yeah,
that was my time as well.
Yeah. And I remember it being restricted only to, first was only restricted to, it seemed like white people, white girls in particular. And yeah, now it has exploded to that's just a way a lot of young people talk. Little boys included. I've heard little boys talk like that.
And no, my little boys, my little black boys talk that way.
Right. And so it's just, it's a change that happened within our lifetime that we could actually see. So,
no, that's a good example. Yeah. And when you said that, of course, the first thing my brain went to was like, stop trying to make fetch happen. It's not going
to
happen.
Right, right. So you can see those little sound changes. And I love seeing those things. I know they probably annoy a lot of people, but when I see those things happening, I'm like, oh, cool. Yay.
It does bring up an interesting thing, though, because you mentioned that, using Valley speak. There are, you know, it was originally kind of like from the ethos of it is around white girls in the Bay, you know, the Bay rather, in the OC rather, but but black folks that grew up in the OC talk like that too, you know, it just depends on where you grew up and where you came from. And then you hear people in New York or someone like me from Portland can pick that style of talk up. Is it appropriate? So then pivoting, when is it appropriate to for someone like me to study or learn about Kalinago, and when does appreciation become appropriation?
I think in this talk of appropriation, we have to remember that, and what often doesn't get talked about is that there's a power dynamic in appropriation. And so it's not just, hey, if you learn my language, you're appropriating it. It's more of if you learn the language and then you decide, hey, you know, maybe I want to copyright this and use it for my brand. And then you spread it around and you have that power to completely change the meaning that a Kalinago person doesn't. That's when I think it becomes the level of appropriation. So that's where you get into the field of Native American mascots and where they're appropriating, because they have millions and millions of dollars to redefine what that Native American is, Native American image is. And that's appropriation. And so if you wanted to learn Kalinago, I'd say fine. I'd probably want to make sure that the community's needs are taken first. So, taken care of first. So my thing is creating language materials for the community that's more accessible for them. And then the community gets to decide whether they want to open it up or not. And then you can go from there, but I wouldn't say if you right now were like, hey, can I learn Kalinago? I'm not going to say, oh my gosh, you're appropriating. Cause I don't think that it is.
I think that the example of copywriting is a really good one. I was thinking about, the Tesla company and how they named their company Tesla, and they didn't have to ask the Tesla family or Nikola Tesla's, you know, they took over his name, paid nothing for it. Right. So if I decided to make a new electric car and I called it, you know, the Kalinago, you know, and then, you know, a year later I become famous and popular, I have just completely appropriated the name of something without paying anyone and turned it into a thing.
Right. That is
not the original thing. That is a great example that you had there.
Right.
And the other point about putting the tools to learn a language in the hands and in the form of the people who need it the most. For example, my wife speaks Ndebele, which is like a Zulu or Bantu language. When I learn it, I am reading there's not a lot of like, hey, white folks, learn Zulu. You know, like docs, there's no books on that. So I'm reading the books that she learned from, you know what I mean? Because those are the books where that was needed. So in what form do you put the things to teach Kalinago? Is it multimedia? Is it books? Is it an app for their phones? Is it paper? How do you teach this?
So what I'm working on, so in the Caribbean, getting internet was really hard in the past. Getting high-speed internet was really hard. When I went there in 2011, I remember having to we had to park outside this tourist bar. We drive like a couple minutes to park outside this tourist bar to get like to hijack their free Wi-Fi. So it really wasn't accessible. And then a lot of people get things on their phone is through credits through their phone company. So they buy a card for $20 credits, mm-hmm. and they use that until, you know, it gets used up. So I definitely want to make sure that things that they can use won't take a lot of bandwidth, for example, won't take a lot of their data, will be easily accessible through phones, because that's the way most people connect to the internet is through phones. Mm-hmm. So I was trying to think about just ways that I can distribute this material. And finally, I mean, this happened really recently. I thought probably the best way would be to distribute it by an ebook, because that way you get a small download. It's made for mobile devices. You can put multimedia in it if you want. It doesn't have to play. So it's something that's small, won't take a lot of bandwidth, but still is mobile friendly. So I'm working on that right now.
Interesting. That's a good idea. I saw that there were some people, I think his name was Dr. Martin Benjamin, working on a thing called the Kamusi Project, KAMUSI. Mm. He wanted to make a Swahili to English dictionary available to feature phones and did it with texting. So when people hear a word they don't understand, they can text the phonetic sounds of what they heard, and then it will text back the word in their language. So they basically have an English Swahili dictionary over textings. So you could potentially expand to feature phones.
Yeah, that sounds really cool, actually. It's a really cool idea.
So is that the kind of things to think about? Like, you can't just say, yeah, we'll make this great multimedia app, right, and we'll have all these videos and everything. Right. That's not necessarily the way that they need it.
Right. Yeah. You know, and most of the devices are Android, if any. I mean, just a couple of years ago, people were still using Blackberries. So, they were really popular there. So it's not like I could just make this cool iOS app and have everybody use it, because they didn't have access to that. And it's really expensive. Mm-hmm. So, you know, those are the sorts of things that I have to think about. But essentially, I think of mobile first, something that's small and easily accessible on mobile phones. And then, expand from there.
So then let's say that we get, you know, is this taught in schools? You know, how many years until you can say that it is now not a dormant language? Do you have Kalinago tables where people are getting together and chatting? You know, how much time do you spend speaking it so you don't forget?
Mm-hmm. So I think the way a language becomes living, or the way language lives, is through children. So if you have 100 adults speaking a language and there are no children learning it, your language is dead, essentially. It's on its way out. So what you need is to raise children in the language. And so what needs to happen is we need a Kalinago baby to be raised fluently in Kalinago. And that's probably won't happen for a while. I mean, I'll do it with my own future kids if that happens. But until that happens, then that language can't be living, or awake. But it's getting there. It's getting there. And what I think needs to happen is, so we have a lot of language materials that are across, different languages. So I'm working with materials that were written, like Kalinago French dictionary, and then I have a Kalinago Spanish translation, and then there's some Arawak Dutch, you know, dictionaries. And so I'm working with all these languages, and I love, you know, I love learning languages, but it does make things very slow. It does make getting material out very slow, because first I have to translate things, and then I have to cross check the translation, and then I have to compare it with the related language. So, it's a lot for one person. So what I'm hoping is that I can get more Kalinago members, or more members from the Indigenous Caribbean community to help out more with, getting these language documentation, accessible to other people. And then we can start to create curriculum and materials and classes and language tables for them. And a lot of it is just, you know, plain old financial support. So I'm trying to go to the Caribbean this year, but it's a bit expensive getting to Dominica. They don't have a international airport, and you can only fly there during the day, because you sort of come in through these two mountains, and it's too dangerous to fly in at night. And So it's just, it's a very hard to get into, a very hard country to get into, but it's beautiful. If you ever have a chance to visit, I definitely recommend it. It's called the Nature Island because it's not very a heavily touristy island. So there's a lot of just lush green rainforest. There's a huge hiking trail, little volcano. Like it's just gorgeous.
Isn't that where Boiling Lake is?
I believe so.
And Trafalgar Falls, if I recall.
I mean, there's a lot of waterfalls. There's a lot of little springs. It's just a gorgeous, gorgeous island.
Let me ask you this. How big are these different languages? Like, I know that English is rather a viral language. It steals very much and it consumes other things, you know? Mm-hmm. I think we're something like 2 or 3 million words right now, but the average person's vocabulary is what? Somewhere between 50 and 100,000 in a daily or monthly basis?
Yeah.
But there are other languages that are smaller. Like, again, using the languages I'm familiar with, like my wife's language, they maybe only have 15, 20,000 words total.
Mm-hmm.
And then they borrow, right?
Right, right.
So, for example, they don't have a word for phone. They just say ifona. Mm-hmm. So they would say, telefona, give me the phone.
Oh, awesome.
Is that, right, is ifona, is that phone? Well, yeah, they've made it that word. They stole it just like we stole all of our languages. So how many words is Kalinago? How many are loan words? And how many would you need to know to consider yourself fairly fluent and then be able to use it in your day to day?
So Kalinago historically, so in the region, originally was the French. So we do actually have some French words, but most of the language, I'd say the two main linguistic inputs to the Kalinago language. So overall, it's an Arawakan language. It's from the Arawakan stock. And then there are words from Carib. So there's not a lot recorded. So we probably have about 4,000 words recorded. Mm-hmm. And in terms of making new things, so different languages have different strategies to making new words. So some languages like English borrow, mm-hmm. just take the word and maybe change the pronunciation a little bit. And some mm-hmm. languages have different ways that you can describe what's happening or describe mm-hmm. the item. So for something like, so when I wanted to talk about internet, I made a Kalinago word, tikanchipi, which means fast net. And so I can use things, I can use descriptions of what that item is and make a new word without having to say something like internet or something like that, you know, which is kind of weird.
No, it is weird. It reminds me of when I went to Japan and we went to get hamburgers at McDonald's.
Yeah. So yeah, it's kind of like that. Kalinago, we don't like consonant clusters, so we tend to put consonants in there and, but what I try to do is first see if we can make a word from it. If it's just, mm-hmm. you know, too difficult, then I'd go to a related language, see if they have a word there. If that doesn't work, then go wider until the last resort is just borrowing it wholesale from, you know, English or something. So that's
interesting, though, because that is almost cultural, though, because English doesn't feel bad at all about borrowing from other words.
No.
Well, you know, the French are maybe more protective of their language, and mm-hmm. they don't like, you know, le weekday. You know, they prefer it to be something different, le weekend, you know. So that idea of protectionism around your language definitely makes sense, especially when there are so few people speaking it, and then with a smaller vocabulary, it makes sense also to combine them like German into longer, almost sentence-like words.
Right. And Kalinago is like that. It's a very, so we start our sentences with verbs and you can do a whole bunch of things with verbs. So it's easy to make things or describe things and use verbs. We have a good process for doing that. So, when in doubt, that's what I do.
Very cool. So people can find you on Twitter at iHeartLang, LANG.
Mm-hmm.
And where are some resources? I'm sure they can go and Google for Kalinago, but where could they go and learn about your work, maybe read about your thesis, and possibly donate?
I have a website. It's kmjosephs.github.io. And mm-hmm. I'll put some stuff up on there where they can go and find some resources there. I don't have any up at the time. I'm working on the website, but I'm working on a lot of websites. So mm-hmm. as my mom would say, the cobbler has the worst shoes.
Absolutely. Maybe you could do me the pleasure of the kindness of, rather than me doing my thank you so much for joining us today and thank you for listening, you could exit us in Kalinago.
Oh, wow. I will say hahong, thank you. And that's about it.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.